laws and strife. Dumpster fire vibe. Come on. All American why? All American why? All American why? Ask yourself the American why.
Hey, excessive thinkers. It's a good day for excessive thinking. And today's topic comes with a content warning from reality itself. Possible side effects include existential dread, uncomfortable questions, and a sudden urge to yell at the concept of business as usual. Because in the last few years, parts of the world have been on fire, underwater, and overheating, sometimes all at once. And that's before we even get to society, politics, or whatever else this timeline decided to throw at us. Honestly, if this were a movie, critics would say the plot was unrealistic and needed some editing. The studio notes would be like, we love the concept, but can we have less things on fire, both figuratively and literally? For me, this stopped being abstract a while ago. I live in Portland, Oregon. My husband is a native Oregonian. I'm one of those Californians who moved here about 10 years ago. So yes, I already know. I'm sorry. Please don't throw artisanal coffee at me. We have this running joke that pretty soon I'll be growing avocados and oranges in our yard. Well, that's what I would like to do at least. My husband does not like this joke at all. And climate change isn't actually funny. I just really would like to have avocados and oranges in our yard. In 2023 and 2024, the planet recorded the hottest years ever measured. We watch wildfires in Canada turn skies orange across the eastern U.S., which is not the seasonal aesthetic anyone wanted. We saw historic floods in Pakistan affect tens of millions of people and wipe out homes, roads, and crops. Europe has been hit by record-breaking heat waves that push power grids to their limits and sent people to the hospital. And closer to home, California and Oregon have faced fire seasons that are longer and more disruptive than what we used to consider normal. If you're keeping score at home, this is what scientists would probably call bad. At the same time, coastal cities from Miami to Norfolk to parts of Southeast Asia now deal with flooding even when it isn't raining. Insurance markets are shifting. Power grids are under stress during heat waves and cold snaps. Food prices reflect heat, drought, floods, and extreme weather. These aren't isolated incidents. They're exactly the kinds of impacts scientists warned us about, and they're happening now. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is now over 420 parts per million. Before the industrial era, it was about 280. The last decade was the hottest decade ever recorded. Climate-related disasters cost hundreds of billions of dollars a year globally, and that cost shows up in taxes, insurance, groceries, healthcare, and whether communities can recover after the next fire, flood, or storm. So if it feels like everything is more expensive and more fragile, it is. This is not a future problem, this is a present tense problem. This is the future calling to say to all of us, please stop making this worse. And yet somehow, we're still debating. Today's question is climate change real? The science part is not the mystery anymore. Today's question is, why are we still debating climate change when action is the only option? Just to be clear, this isn't climate change 101. This is about why. Why, in a world where the measurements are clear and the impacts are visible, we're stuck in argument mode instead of build mode. Because even if you think climate change is mostly human-caused, partly natural, or something else entirely, if the climate is changing, we still have to adapt to it. We still have to protect people. We still have to fix systems that are clearly under strain. And even if you don't believe in climate change, and yes, I'm putting that in air quotes, believe, you still need clean air. You still breathe. You still need clean water. You still drink. You probably don't want toxic chemicals in your soil, plastic in your food, or smoke in your lungs. And if you do want those things, please see a professional. At minimum, building cleaner energy, cleaner industry, and cleaner infrastructure makes people healthier and communities more resilient. At minimum, building cleaner energy, cleaner industry, and cleaner infrastructure makes people healthier and communities more resilient. At best, it helps us avoid the worst outcomes scientists are warning us about. Here's the core tension in one sentence. This is not a science problem anymore. It's a people, power, and politics problem. We act like we're a small, fragile country that can't do big things anymore. Which is wild because this is the same country that built the interstate highway system, created Social Security, passed the GI Bill, mobilized its economy to win World War II, put people on the moon, and built the early internet with public investment. We didn't get any of that by saying, sorry, this is the best we can do. We don't lack capacity, we lack political will and moral clarity. And the truth is, we already know what a lot of the big moves are. We need to rebuild and modernize the electric grid so it can handle renewables, storage, extreme heat, extreme cold, and the reality that everything is getting electrified. We need real multimodal transportation so people can move around by trains, buses, bikes, walking, and yes, cars, without every trip requiring a small personal loan and a tank of fossil fuels. We need to retrofit and weatherize millions of buildings so they don't waste as much energy and keep people safe during heat waves and cold snaps. We need to fix water systems so lead isn't a surprise feature and drought doesn't become a permanent condition. We need to invest in wildfire prevention, forest restoration, and community hardening so fire season isn't a yearly roulette wheel. We need coastal protection and smarter flood management so cities aren't slowly turning into part-time swimming pools. We need to rebuild domestic manufacturing for clean energy, batteries, heat pumps, wind turbines, solar, and grid equipment generally, so the energy transition is also a green jobs transition. None of this is science fiction. It's construction. It's planning. It's coordination. It's the same kind of national effort we've pulled off before when we've decided that something actually mattered.
Your support doesn't disappear into the algorithm. It goes straight into making episodes, elevating smart voices, and building the kind of podcast that actually practices what it preaches.
And this is where the Green New Deal comes in. It was never just more solar panels. It was a framework that said climate action, jobs, infrastructure, health, housing, and justice are connected. You don't fix one in isolation. You rebuild the system so that it works for the people and doesn't cook the planet at the same time. We can argue about the details. We can argue about the timelines, the costs, the implementation. That's normal. That's democracy. But the scale of the idea is not radical. It's historically normal for a country facing a real crisis that must do something. And then there's Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. Whatever you think of the name or of Joe Biden, in practice, it's the biggest climate and clean energy investment the United States has ever made. Massive tax credits and funding for clean power, batteries, electric vehicles, heat pumps, domestic manufacturing, and pollution reduction were part of this act. It's the closest thing we've had to turning that Green New Deal scale into actual projects. But will it survive? That law still exists, but laws can be weakened without being repealed. Funds can be frozen, rules can be rewritten, enforcement can be slowed. We've already seen major fights over climate funding and agency authority. And that brings us to the part where things get genuinely scary. Right now, the EPA, under Trump, has moved to rip out the legal foundation for regulating greenhouse gases by rescinding the 2009 endangerment finding. That's a load-bearing beam in United States climate law. They're also weakening pollution rules, including standards for toxic emissions from power plants. This isn't just a policy disagreement. This is dismantling the machinery that protects public health while all of our disasters are accelerating. And while we're here, we should talk about what we're putting into the world. Plastic is now everywhere. In the ocean, in food chains, in our bodies, we've invented a whole new category of chemicals called forever chemicals, which is not a great branding choice. But PFAS, P-F-A-S, are in water supplies, consumer products, and ecosystems. And they don't break down easily. Forever is a very long time to be wrong about safety. Even if you don't care about climate politics, do you really want a world where the air, water, and soil are increasingly contaminated? Environmental protection isn't a luxury, it's basic public health. Or if we put it another way, not being slowly poisoned is a pretty reasonable life goal. If an individual dumped toxins into a river, we wouldn't call that innovation. We'd call that a crime. Companies that produce pollution, waste, and toxic byproducts should be held to standards that protect the public. Cleaning up after yourself isn't radical, it's accountability. And yes, this connects right back to climate, because the same systems that treat pollution as the cost of doing business are the ones telling us we should just accept more heat, more smoke, more floods, and more sickness as normal. So when people ask why we're still debating, here's the honest answer. Debate is a delay strategy. Debate is how you protect the status quo while pretending you're just asking questions. Debate is how you turn the house is on fire into a panel discussion about whether the fire is real. Climate action is not a moment or a vibe. It is construction, it is power plants, it is transmission lines, it is charging stations, heat pumps, insulation, batteries, forest and wetland restoration, industrial upgrades. It is all these things. So what does this mean for you? I know this can feel so big, and that people start thinking, okay, cool. I know about Al Gore and An Inconvenient Truth. I do my part. What can I do personally? The answer is you need a voice, a vote, and a community. You need to show up. You need to push. You need to be annoying on purpose, because facts don't move policy by themselves. People do. Humans are very good at defending the status quo, very bad at changing systems that still sort of work, and extremely susceptible to fear, identity, and bad faith narratives. This problem is not just a data problem, it's a human behavior problem, which is exactly why this episode isn't just about how bad things are, even though I've talked about that. It's about how change actually happens. How do you break through the noise? How do you make this real to people who don't live in policy papers? How do ordinary people push systems that feel immovable? And that brings me to today's guest. My guest today is Brian Ettling, a former park ranger turned climate change comedian, longtime climate communicator, and organizer with Citizens Climate Lobby. Look, I love an Ivy League environmentalist as well, and we need them, but I also wanted to talk to someone on the ground, someone who spends their time talking to regular people, organizing, showing up, and translating all of this into human language. Because if this only lives in academic journals, agency reports, and think tank panels, it doesn't move the world. And I want you to hear this. This is an all-hands-on-deck approach, and your involvement is meaningful. This is not a spectator sport. Systems change when enough ordinary people decide that later is not an acceptable answer anymore. Brian, Welcome to All American Why.
Enjoying the show? Help us keep asking the questions Thanksgiving dinner tries to avoid. Support the podcast or explore sponsorship opportunities at www.allamericanwhypodcast.com. We're grateful you're part of the slightly excessive thinking community.
Hey, Brian.
Hello, Michael.
How's it going?
Great.
You're actually doing this coming straight from a civic event. I'm not surprised.
I don't. Anybody that would know me would not be surprised. Yeah, I'm always going to town halls and, yeah, try to go to as many civic events as I can. For me, I don't like sitting around at home. Well, actually, some nights I do, but I like being out in and about the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Okay, so I know you and I, sometimes we have lunch, we talk about climate change, yes. We talk about politics. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I really wanted to have you on because you are doing the thing. You're not an environmental scientist. You're not, and I don't mean you're not as in there's a deficit. I mean, citizen out there arguing for things that are premised in decency, right? So, I mean, tell us, like, how did this all happen? Kind of where did this evolve? You know, I know you were a park ranger.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So take us back and then walk us through how you ended up where you're at now doing all kinds of sort of not just climate stuff, but other stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, my name is Brian Etling, and I'm originally from St. Louis, Missouri. That's where I was born and raised, went to high school, and went to college in Kansas City. And actually, I got a degree in business administration. But I just didn't want to spend my whole life in an office cubicle. And so I was able to find a way to work in the national parks. I worked at Crater Lake in Southern Oregon for 25 years. But Crater Lake was always a summer seasonal gig, so I had to find a place to work in the wintertime. And so I worked in Everglades National Park in South Florida. So for years, I actually went back and forth. I was my own winter bird, if you want to think of it that way, you know. And I started doing programs in the national parks around 1998 in the Everglades. And one of the things I learned quickly is that people expect park rangers to know everything, don't you? And people started asking me about this climate change thing back in 1998, and I knew nothing about it, and not knowing anything about it was not going to make any park visitor happy, so I had to literally run to the nearest bookstore and park library just to learn what I could, and it scared me as far back as 1998, 1999 to learn that, you know, the Everglades is right at sea level, and they were talking, even in the Everglades, back around the turn of the millennium, that we could have 3-foot sea level rise in this century due to climate change, due to melting of Greenland and Antarctica. And so here I am, I'm just a happy park naturalist showing people alligators, dolphins, manatees, colorful wading birds. And I'm reading that if we continue on this trajectory, we could like lose most of the Everglades because, you know, the highest point in the park is only 8 feet above sea level. And so it was really starting to bother me over the years. And then I saw, but I didn't know what to do about it. And then I saw Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's film in 2006. And again, I didn't know what to do about it. But by 2008, I figured I got to do something. So I literally gave up my winter gig in the Everglades. And I figured I'll go back to my hometown of St. Louis to start doing something to organize about it. National park audiences are interesting, especially in South Florida. Mm-hmm. Because they're either 100% on your side, they're tree huggers, they're progressive, they care about the environment, and they want to hear that you care about the environment. Or in the case of like Florida, they're going to Disney World, they're going to Miami Beach, and they don't want to hear that the environment's going to hell. So I had one in two extremes. I figured I go back to St. Louis and try to talk to average Joes if I could. So I started doing some organizing in St. Louis. I worked at the St. Louis Science Center. They had a climate change exhibit, which really was helpful for me because I knew so little about this subject. And it wasn't that well of a tenet of an exhibit, so I got to spend hours just taking notes about the science of climate change. And then I joined a Toastmasters group in 2011, and about a third of that group was climate deniers, so I got to practice speeches with them.
Interesting.
Yeah, and what also happened in St. Louis is that when I was working at the science exhibit, I met a gentleman who was in, he was a businessman in St. Louis. He worked for Energizer. I almost said Energizer as Energizer Bunny, but Energizer. But he was really worried about it. And he was involved with meetup groups. And he was like, do you want to start a climate change meetup group? And I said, sure. And he goes, great. You're now the co-founder. So in St. Louis, I was able to start a climate change meetup group. I first got involved with Citizens Climate Lobby in St. Louis. In the summer of 2012, I became involved with Al Gore's group, Climate Reality Project. So for me, for several years, I thought, you know, it sounds really bad in Florida, but Oregon's doing great. Crater Lake's doing great. But then I started noticing climate change happening at Crater Lake with the snowpack going down. I could literally see it because many years I lived in the same residence at Crater Lake. I've got pictures of years with tremendous snowpack and years with really lousy snowpack. And I was starting to see more of those years with lousy snowpack. The fire season was getting worse. There would be times where the smoke was so bad you didn't want to breathe it. But then one of my jobs as a park ranger at Crater Lake was just answering the phones and answering emails. And people would say to me, we want to come visit your park, but my mom or my kid has asthma. Should I come? And I have to say, well, it depends on which way the wind is blowing. You know, because if the wind is blowing a certain direction, you're going to have a great time. But if it's blowing the wrong direction, it's going to be awful. And then there's other little subtle things that happen at Crater Lake, too. The surface temperature of the water was going up. More beetles were surviving the winter and attacking the trees. So over the years, it was really starting to bother me that I was getting more. I wanted to do things I couldn't do as a park ranger, such as lobbying, writing letters to the editor, because I was writing letters to the editor and I was getting published in like the Oregonian way down in Crater Lake, but it was starting to make the park superintendent a little bit uncomfortable. You know, my political, the park was very supportive about it, but they're all, they were like, what are you doing in your off time? I mean, so I kind of wanted to do this full time. And what happened is that I was wintering in St. Louis up about 2016. And by the way, I met my wife at my climate change meetup group. She came to one of the events. You know, I'll never forget, she was sitting at a bar having birch beer, you know, and I was like, oh, what you drinking there? And so my pickup line was, can we get together sometime for coffee and practice one of my climate change talks with you? And it worked. And so I met my wife, Tanya, through my climate change organizing.
And then she warmed up to you.
Yeah, she I'm stealing that. I never thought about that before. She warmed up to me, fortunately. And what happened is that, so I was still spending my summers at Crater Lake. It was a little bit hard on our marriage. She couldn't get a job in St. Louis. She was a cytotechnologist. She screens pap smears. You know, she works in a lab. And Portland was like, well, heck yeah, we'll hire you. And so we moved out here in 2017. But by 2017, I really wanted to do this year-round. So I've been pretty much organizing year-round since like the fall of 2017 for Climate Action.
Tell us more about what you do for Climate Action and what the organization is.
Yeah, so I'm involved with multiple organizations because there's multiple organizations doing great things, and everyone has a little bit different angle of how they do things. So on the federal angle, I've been involved with Citizens Climate Lobby, and so they lobby Congress on different congressional bills. For years, they were trying to get a carbon fee and dividend passed, like a carbon tax, but they've had a really tough time with Congress trying to get that done. So they're trying to get other bills on the federal level. On the state level, when I first got involved on the state level, I was involved with Renew Oregon. They were trying to get a cap and invest bill passed. They tried really hard in 2019 and 2020. The only thing that prevented that from getting passed was the Republican walkouts in the legislature, which we could go into more details about. But the Republicans were able to prevent that. And then I got involved with a group that spun out from 350. It's a group called Mobilizing for Climate Action Together, MCAT. They lobby on the state level. I'll be going to their lobby day on Tuesday. And then I'm real involved with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, OLCV. And those are the main groups I can think of off the top of my head, but I can think of more that I show up for meetings and that I partner with also.
Yeah, that's great. I know you were on Tosh.0.
Yes, and, twice.
You know, your mom was also on
yes.
it.
And my dad.
And your dad. Yeah, and you call yourself a climate comedian.
Yeah.
I mean, can you tell us, not only tell us about that, but also like maybe give us a joke or two?
Well, what? Yeah, I skipped over that part of my story. So I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. I'll be honest with you and everyone listening here. I was a seasonal. I loved being a seasonal park ranger, but it was seasonal. It was not exactly the most stable lifestyle. And so what happened was that in 2009, I thought I would be going back to St. Louis, but I made a good. I met some good friends down there at Crater Lake. And he's like, hey, my mom is looking for someone to house sit for in Ashland, Oregon. And if you've been to Ashland, it's just so beautiful. And I was going to be there in the fall. I had a cat sit. And it was a gorgeous cat. And I'm just sitting in this house in Ashland, just bored. I mean, it was beautiful in Ashland. I was going on nice walks, but I was trying to figure out what to do. I was kind of, I got enrolled for like a day into a graduate program in SOU, but I was like, I don't know if I want to do a business management program. I met with the professor down there who knows a lot about climate, but we didn't exactly gel. He was saying kind of some derogatory things about Al Gore, and I actually have had great interactions with Al Gore and attending his trainings. So I'm at a friend's house. Just feeling like, what should I do with my life? And then she started pressing me on it. What do you want to do with your life? You know, just really, what like a good friend should, you know, just like, you know, really trying to beat it out of me. And I said, fine, if I could do anything, I'd like to be the climate change comedian. And it worked at that moment. I mean, she thought I was laughing and she said, I want you to grab the website domain, which I did, climatechangecomedian.com. And I still use it to this day. And so then I had to kind of build the website, and I wasn't really sure exactly what to do. Kind of part of the background with this is that one of the things I quickly learned as a park ranger is that the public expects you to be funny. They don't want you to be too funny, but they don't want you to. It's not a college lecture either. They want to know that you're having fun. You know, they're on vacation. Tell me something funny. You know, so I kind of had to. I kind of made some of my own jokes, but then the nice thing about being park rangers is that we steal from each other also. But when you're a park ranger, you're wearing that uniform, people think they just love park rangers. So you could tell a half-assed joke and people laugh really hard. So it kind of puts you in a headspace that you could do stand-up comedy. So just from my background of being a park ranger, of having to try to entertain people as well as educate and inspire people, I came up with this title, The Climate Change Comedian. So then what I did is I did a video with my wife where she played the violin. I was trying to promote her business also. She's a professional violinist.
Yeah.
And she does...
Your mom plays piano, right?
My mom plays piano, yeah. So my first video was with my then girlfriend, Tanya, my now wife. My second one was my mom, and I was promoting my mom as a piano player also because she does gigs all the time in St. Louis. If you're anybody from St. Louis listening to this, she still plays her parties at... almost 86 years old. She's still super active. I doubt I'll be as active as her at 85 years old. So I did a video with my Tanya, with my mom, and then Tanya and my mom. And then one day my dad says, well, I want to do a video with me. And my dad was a Trumpist, kind of a MAGA person, but he still wanted to do a video with me, you know, and I did apparently influence him. And that video turned out good also. And it was all those videos that caught the attention of Tosh.0. The show itself, which was that was kind of a funny phone call also, because I was actually getting ready to pack to head back to Crater Lake. And this was a call in early April of 2016. We're coming up on the 10 year anniversary of this. And my mom says, Brian, the phone's from you. It's somebody from Los Angeles. And I don't really know anybody from Los Angeles unless they're like a movie star or something.
Yeah.
And so this he goes, hi, I'm from Tosh.0. Can I ask you a few questions? And I'm like, sure. And, you know, he's asking about the climate change comedian and just trying to get a feel of who I am.
Sure.
And he goes to me, he goes, we'd like to invite you out to Los Angeles, fly you out to Los Angeles this week. Can you come out here this week? And I'm like, sure. I mean, perfect timing. If he would ask me a week or two later, I would have been committed to heading back out west. And I said, sure, I can do it. And then he said, do you think your mom would be interested? So I said, well, I can ask her. So my parents were kind of out and about, and they came home, and I said, Mom, this show, Tosh.0, wants me to come out to Los Angeles, the TV show. And they're also asking if you'd like to come. Would you like to come? And she goes, Yeah, like that. My mom's a big ham also. If you saw any of the videos. But then my mom said to me, she goes, you better tell Tanya what you're doing, because she had planned a honeymoon for you guys this week. So one of our gifts, we got married in November 2015, and one of the gifts was a bed and breakfast in Augusta, Missouri. Hmm. So during that Tosh.0 phone call, he says, well, do you have anything going on this week? I said, well, I've got a honeymoon. And the guy from Tosh.0 goes, oh, where? And I, because he's probably thinking, you know, Paris, Niagara Falls, Las Vegas, you know, somewhere ultimately romantic and, you know, and fun. And I said, Augusta, Missouri. And this guy from Los Angeles goes, Augusta, Missouri? And I said, yeah, Augusta, Missouri. It's wine country. And he goes, he's from California. He goes, Augusta, Missouri, wine country. And I said, well, it's wine country from Missouri. And so then he felt so bad that he actually flew my wife out there also. So here's the three of us on we're supposed to be going on a bed and breakfast. We still fit it in later in the week. So it was myself, my wife, and my mother that flew out to Los Angeles to be on the show. And it was a blast. It was a lot of fun to do that.
Yeah. And for folks who haven't seen it yet, look for the clips are still on your website, right?
It's on my website. But if you look up my name, which is Brian Etling, climate change comedian, Tosh.0, it'll pop right up. It should pop right up for you.
So can you tell us, like, give us some humor, you know, because people need that right now, right?
Especially,
it's like the world's on fire, really, like real fire. And then the world's on fire, like in a chaos way. So can you give us some levity?
Well, my tagline that I came up with, I kind of stole it from Seinfeld, but it was kind of my own spin on it, is when I was doing these videos with my mom, with Tanya, and with my dad, I would try to do something funny and they would just say, no, you're not that funny, like that, you know, in the video, because I was like, oh my God, how am I going to live up to this? Because it's natural as a park ranger where you can say some things, we steal jokes from each other, we get funny things from the visitors also. Like, you know, we were talking before about, oh, Tanya, and she warmed up to me. You know, I, as a park ranger, I would steal that joke. I would steal from visitors.
What are some park ranger jokes? And then we can get into the other jokes.
Yeah, they're not that great, but they're probably at funnier in a national park. But the one that I came up with, I feel like I came up with, but I've heard it elsewhere too. But what did one continental plate say to the other after the earthquake?
It's time to shift? No. I don't know.
Yeah, there's many ways to go with this. My answer was, it's not my fault.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so, but that was such a bad joke. I actually never used that as a park ranger, but I had coworkers that did.
Yeah, so park ranger jokes are basically dad jokes, but about nature.
Yeah, I guess you can say that. I mean, we think we're really funny, though. But yeah, you're right. It's kind of dad jokes. And some of those are better than others with that. But for me, humor was about, humor's often best on the spot. It's like the interaction we're happening right now. Just something comes into our heads and it's funny. There's a comedian that I've followed for years, and he's the science comedian, Brian Malo. And I might be mispronouncing his last name. It's spelled Malow. And he's out of North Carolina. And he said that dissecting humor is like dissecting a frog. Both die in the process.
Kyle, our producer's laughing in the sound booth.
So it's hard to dissect humor. It's hard to think of humor. Humor just kind of happens. But I, for me, though, I had to think of something. It's such a dour subject.
Yeah, that was my next question, how do you joke about something that's so real or catastrophic?
Yeah, and great question, Michael. What I did was, from 2011 to 2017, my evening program at Crater Lake was on climate change. And so what I did was, when I was constructing this program, I was talking with that, I just made myself the butt of the jokes, that I'm just the biggest idiot out there trying to learn this. So, and I had people laughing with me on this, and I felt like anybody that my program probably self-censored people, because our programs are listed in the park. So if you hate the subject of climate change or don't believe in it, it probably, those people were like, oh, I'm not going to that program tonight, you know. So I had very few people that argued with me about that. But when I put the program together, I had slides in myself, you know, trying to figure out the science of it. I always made fun of myself, you know, of not being that funny, of not really totally understanding the science, of just getting in stupid, ridiculous situations. So maybe I'm more like the Lucille Ball.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Maybe something like
that. So like you're stuffing chocolates down your blouse.
Kind of like that. And, you know, and I, for lack of, maybe lack of creativity, maybe for some people might say this, would be, with the video with my first video, my wife, and then my mom and my dad, I used rubber chickens in it. You know, just, and that was because I had these rubber chickens at Cradle Lake. And I didn't know what to do with them. Maybe I can use them for this. Because Tosh called me out and goes, what are you using rubber chickens for? Do you actually think they're funny? And there's actually a story behind that, because, you know, these subjects like climate change and first aid and CPR, they're not funny on their own. But one of the best ways to teach it to people is by using humor. So in 2011, we always had training at Crater Lake for basic first aid and CPR, led by the law enforcement rangers who actually double as EMTs. So the thing about me being a park ranger is that I was often the first on scene for any kind of accident or medical situation. So we need to be well trained on this. And so for the rangers, the law enforcement rangers, they need us paying attention. They need us taking this seriously. But at the same time, it's a heavy subject. You know, the information is going to stick in our brains more if we can remember a little bit of humor with it. So my friend Peter Sween, who was a law enforcement ranger, he came up with this idea that he had six rubber chickens, and they had different ailments. One was pregnant, one had a broken leg, one had a heart attack, one had a head trauma injury, and then we had to figure out what we were going to do with these rubber chickens. And so I was coming in as the French waiter with these rubber chickens. So Peter Sween asked me, he said, he was a law enforcement ranger.
No, when you said French waiter, I was thinking like the chef from Little Mermaid, or like some sort of movie scene.
Yeah, like a movie scene. The rude French waiter, or, you know, the obtuse French waiter, kind of what he had in mind. And he asked, so Peter had to come up with the props for this. And, you know, and then this is way back in like 2010, where, you know, Amazon was around and all. It was going to be easy. But he goes, he was afraid to go to the chief ranger to ask for six rubber chickens. I mean, I law enforcement ranger asks for supplies all the time. And so he goes, can you ask your boss to order six rubber chickens? And I said, sure, I'm game for anything. If you hang out with me.
Game isn't a chicken. No, game, a chicken.
Game is like, isn't it mammals? Like that, like deer and.
Yeah, that joke doesn't work. That was a foul attempt.
See, humor has to work in the moment here. So, but I'll never forget this, though, because I went to my boss, and he was the mellow Hawaiian, just a really super nice guy, Eric. And I said, Eric, I need you to order six rubber chickens for our first aid skit. Mm-hmm. And Eric goes, and why am I ordering six rubber chickens? I'm like, well, you know, it's for help us learn first aid. And he goes, are you ever going to use these rubber chickens again? And I go, oh, sure, yeah. And so I still have three out of six of these rubber chickens. I'm still trying to figure out what to do with them.
Where are the other three?
I don't know. I think I've had a few friends take them over the years off my hands. But not that many. I'm stuck with them.
Your support turns big questions into real episodes and big values into real action.
You're just one person.
Yeah.
Even though you do, mm-hmm. you think you're, you know, three, and I can relate. There's a lot of people who are overwhelmed, and they don't know what to say, what to do.
Yeah,
they're already having existential dread about five other things, mm-hmm. let alone mm-hmm. this as well.
Yeah.
I guess my question for you is, like, how do you get people to care, and then how do you get people to get involved in whichever way that's best for them?
Yeah, great question here. My life is kind of like, I don't know how many other lives are like this. It's kind of like before COVID and after COVID. But because before COVID, I was doing presentations all the time. And my hook was, well, the comedy. I mean, I actually did get a lot of presentations trying to attempt to have some humor in there. And my hook was always that I was a former park ranger, you know, and I would talk about the national parks. And I would talk about the climate change impact on our national parks, how some of the most beautiful places on the planet that we love to visit are impacted by climate change. And then I would try to provide solutions of what things people can do about it. Mm-hmm. So my hook for years was, yeah, some humor, you know, and I did get, as a Toastmaster, former park ranger, climate reality leader trained by Al Gore. You know, I'm one of thousands of people trained that have attended his trainings, and so I'm a climate reality leader. Also, volunteer with Citizens Climate Lobby. I did a lot of speaking gigs before the pandemic. I ended up speaking in 12 different states, 200 or 300 talks I gave. I've lost track of how many times I've talked. But my hook was kind of national parks with some comedy in there.
Can you give us an example? I know we talked about the earthquake joke with the park rangers. We talked about the chickens.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any like climate change specific joke that I would love to know, and so would the listeners?
I'm rusty. Believe it or not, everything fell off a cliff for me with the pandemic. I was on the go all the time giving presentations, and I just kind of fell out of practice doing presentations, and I've forgotten my jokes that I used to tell about that. I've kind of switched more. I've been doing more writing as far as my blog, but more as far as advocacy, as far as my lobbying. But you caught me off guard. But you know what cracks me up is that in some ways I don't consider myself to be that funny. And so I love now and then reading the comments from the Tosh.0 or for the videos I've done with my parents. And people just trying to really, that guy's not funny, or that guy thinks he's funny, that kind of thing. Is no, I don't really think I'm that funny. The joke's kind of on that person, if they really think I think I'm funny. Yeah. I really don't. I'm just...
But they watched the video, and then they learned about climate change.
Yes.
So you,
yes.
You did your thing.
I did my thing, yeah.
Do you think that you're going to make other videos? Have you thought about that?
No, I have not. I've done some videos this fall, but it was kind of like more like about what five things you can do for our democracy. I did a couple videos like that, one or two like that. But I've not really done any more humor videos like that per se. Mm-hmm. But who knows? I might do it again. It's funny because my wife is getting more back in the habit of playing the violin. Maybe we should do another kind of funny video. And those rubber chickens are just kind of sitting around gathering dust. So I should maybe do something, another one. You know what's hard, Michael, is that after I did Tosh.0, I don't know how I could ever top that. I mean, it was a really cool experience. I mean, maybe I could have aimed higher for Conan O'Brien or to be on the Daily Show or something. But that was it was a dream come true. But at the same time, I'm like, oh my God, I couldn't believe I did that. They actually flew me out to Los Angeles. And for years, I got residual checks from that. So I do recommend folks, if you have a chance, any way possible, get on TV, even for the stupidest way it means, the residual checks that you receive from SAG are really good, from the Screen Actors Guild.
So can you tell us about Citizens Climate Lobby and kind of what kind of things they're working on and how they're dealing with this climate? That's not a joke.
Hey, I got it though. Well, Citizens Climate Lobby, what's interesting is that Citizens Climate Lobby and Climate Reality Group, which is Al Gore's organization, they're a little bit entwined in that the founder, Marshall Saunders, he was in San Diego. He was actually a real estate developer. And he was actually also in, he was a group called Results, which was about ending world poverty, helping people hunger. And they would regularly lobby Congress for hunger programs. And they were very successful in getting money for hunger programs. And so Marshall Saunders took that mode into Citizens Climate Lobby of trying to train people how to lobby your members of Congress. And that's one thing I love about Citizens Climate Lobby is that they used to do it twice a year, but now it's once a year. Their conference is, last 2 years it's been in July. Before that, it was every June. And so they fly people from the people fly from all around the U.S. So you have to, you know, you pay your own ticket to get there or do some fundraising to get there. But they teach you how to lobby Congress, which is really good. And Citizens Climate Lobby, their whole thing is appreciation, respect, and gratitude. Trying to find something in common with that member of Congress, even if they're really far right. Like, for instance, I actually did lobby the office of, like, James Inhofe. And so even these offices that we would agree with them, disagree with them on nearly everything, you can still find something to agree with them on, you know, helping veterans, that kind of thing. And so you start with an appreciation. But Citizens Climate, they really try to teach you to listen, not to go in the office. They try to pride themselves at being the folks with the white hats. And we really try to listen. We try to listen for common ground, hear their positions, and try to see where we can move them where we can.
I mean, I can relate to this in things that I do and lobby for and go to D.C. And it's hard not to be political, but not be political. But I guess my question is, how do you feel, because we're asking people to believe in science and we're asking people who also breathe the same air and use the same water to care about things that they are also using? So, you know, is the time spent giving them facts, hoping they'll believe them? Is the how do we get people who don't believe in, what is it, 98% of scientists agree?
Yeah, 97, 98.
Yeah,
98%, yes. So, great question, Michael. I'll never forget the first time I went to Washington, D.C. in 2015. I am hooked doing this. I love going to D.C. to lobby. So, I didn't move to Portland until 2017. So, initially, I was lobbying from out of my home state of Missouri, which is a total gone off the deep end red state. I do not recognize my home state anymore, just how deeply red it's become. My very first meeting was with the staff of Republican U.S. Senator Roy Blunt. And so a lot of these staffers are in their 20s. And it was this young gal right in front of me. And, you know, I just got married, so I'm not trying to flirt with her. But I asked her, I said, tell me something about yourself. Tell me something that you like to do. Mm-hmm. She goes, oh, my husband and I, we love to go hiking and weekends and national parks.
Oh, wow.
So that was a big cue for me. So that's, I use national parks. I talk, and I still do that. I talk about the national parks when I lobby. That's a big part of it. Or now living in Portland, I love talking about, you know, hiking in the gorge, that kind of thing. So I try to, most of the time you get nearly all the time when you lobby in D.C., you get staff. And it sounds like you've lobbied in D.C. also.
Yeah. And sometimes it's staff. Sometimes it's the member of Congress. Sometimes it's the member of Congress says, hey, I can say hi and wave, but then I need to leave.
Yeah. And it's not a bad thing if you get staff, because if you get the staff on your side, they can bend the ear. But if you don't get the staff on your side, it's basically a slam door. So
that staffer, you know, was probably amused that you were a park ranger.
Yeah.
You know, I like to hike. You like to hike. But also, you don't necessarily believe in climate change, or you're working for a member of Congress who potentially doesn't believe in this or want to help solve this. So I guess, how do we get from, like, the common ground, cute conversation to, okay, this is real, we need for action to happen?
Yeah, great question, Michael. What I thought was fascinating was when I would lobby my member of Congress from St. Louis, her name is Ann Wagner, far right Republican. When I would meet with the staffers, a lot of times they're in their 20s and 30s. They get climate change is real. These staffers get it. The members behind closed doors, they get that climate change is real.
You mean to tell me that they're two different people on Meet the Press and when they're in meetings?
Yeah, they're different when the TV cameras aren't on them. Yes, yes.
Brian.
I know. Hope I'm not bursting anybody's bubble here. But where I'm going with this is that they'll tell me that, yeah, they're concerned about climate change. They would love to do something about it. But in these red districts, these super red districts, they're afraid of getting too far ahead of their voters. And so they'd ask me, they say, are you talking to our voters? What are you doing in the district? And I thought that was really great advice. And So, and they would also say to me, they'd say, do you see our phones right here? Nobody's calling us. And I'm like, oh, wow. It was shocking.
At all or just about that?
About that. Yeah. But there's times in the day where nobody's calling them.
Yeah. Why do you think so? I mean, like if you can't eat, which they don't really care about that either. Mm-hmm. But if you can't eat, you know, that's like an immediate, you know, I need food. You can't pay rent. It's immediate. Yeah. I need money for food. Like, is it that climate change seems so distant because our house is currently not flooding or our, you know, like, it's like, I want to say it would take an actual thing to happen to them to realize, but we had a pandemic and then those learning lessons went away.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess, how do you make this a tangible issue that people care about, even if they're willing to listen? They say, oh, well, one, it's not man-made, or it's this is far away. This is something for other people to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Or what can I do? I just work in an office. I'm not a climate scientist. So how do you get people to go from, whether it's someone in a political office or it's someone you meet?
Yeah,
how do you get them to go from? And not everyone can be an activist. And there's different ways of being an activist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How do you go from I'm open to listening to this to I'm changing my viewpoint on this and I'm learning and I'm taking some actions on it?
Yeah. Great question. There's a group that I highly recommend looking up. It's called the Environmental Voter Project. And I can't remember the gentleman's name that found it at this moment here. And I've seen him give presentations on it. And he gave a presentation back in 2018 that just kind of shook me to my core. What he said, he listed all the issues for the American public. And when you ask Americans about issues that they care about, you know, whether it's healthcare, you know, public safety, immigration, what's the sad part is that climate change is still towards the bottom. Mm-hmm. It's not the most salient issue, is what we're still dealing with in this day and age. You ask Americans, up to 70% of Americans say that they're concerned about climate change, but very few Americans are listing it as their top thing that they're voting on.
And is part of that just the you're so focused on the living and affordability crisis that, you know, if you can't afford groceries, you're not thinking about rising sea levels.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Well, that's one big part of it right there, is that we have a lot of people in the public that are just trying to make it from day to day. But then there's a lot of us who really do care about it and our hair is on fire, but we're not contacting our members of Congress. And as voters, the people who really, this is a top concern of them, we suck as voters, according to the Environmental Voter Project. What the Environmental Voter Project does, it has ways of identifying voters, especially in swing states, who are environmental voters, but don't vote. And so they have volunteers that call up people and they ask them, hey, are you voting? And people lie. Everyone claims.
Meaning there's someone who potentially is registered to vote.
Yeah.
They believe in climate change.
Yes.
But they're not showing up to vote.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, we got a whole... In the 2016 election, I used to have these statistics off the top of my head. It was like somewhere around 10 million people that were identified, where climate and the environment was a top issue, but they didn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an election that was decided by just a few. I mean, I'm rusty now on my 2000. I used to have this off the top of my head, but it's not been the most salient issue for the public. We still have a ways to go as far as getting this where people are really concerned about it. And then the Congress is feeling the heat about it.
Do you think some of this is like the tangibility? So, you know, there's a lot of farmers who are MAGA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, they're like climate deniers. But then if you ask them about their crop production or about things of that nature, they would be like, oh, yeah, the things are changing. Is the issue that they just think that none of that has anything to do with climate change, or we're not going to be able to control any of that, so why bother? Like, I'm trying to get the disconnect between someone who maybe is actually experiencing this, but mm-hmm. then still says, oh, well, that's not anything I can do about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think a big part of it, and I think that we're not going to understand this for a while. I think the biggest elephant in the room in this day and age is all the disinformation out there.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Preach. Tell the people.
Yeah.
That.
There's a really good book out there. Barbara McQuaid wrote the book, and I see if I can pull up the title really quickly here. I actually took a screenshot before it came on.
You mean you want people to actually learn and digest facts and have critical thinking and nuance?
The book is called Attack Within From Within, and it's How Disinformation is Sabotaging America. Barbara McQuaid. I mean, there's a lot of other books written about this subject here, too. But I don't even think we realize...
Yeah, she would be just, like, writing that book endlessly. There's no, like, front and back.
Well, law professor at Michigan State, I believe, out of Michigan, in case I get the wrong university there, too. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of other books written about this, but I don't think we realize the disinformation from the Fox News, mm-hmm. the Rush Limbaugh out there. I'm actually reading a book right now called The Cult of Trump, mm-hmm. and there's all these far-right religious groups, too, and then their whole thing is that you can't accept climate change. So a lot of this is the groupthink.
Which I've always thought it's odd, because in my mind, other than being yourself and diversity, and I'm a spiritual person, not, mm-hmm. you know, sure. a religious person, but to me, the most godly thing would be the environment. Like if you're going to have any sort of purpose mm-hmm. or any sort of protection for you and your family, it would be to protect the creation of the earth, which mm-hmm. is in the Bible and is talked about. So it's like the Bible's not like, it doesn't say like, and you know, I don't know all the Bible verses, but it's not like, you know, God created this beautiful earth and then let's just destroy it.
Yeah.
Like I haven't really seen that section.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up religious. I mean, never liked going to church, but I grew up religious, and all you have to do is, many of us are familiar with Genesis, like the first chapter or after Adam, and God says, you know, take care of my creation. I forget exactly how it was said, but yeah, I mean, we both know that, you know, whether you're spiritually or religious, that there's something, I think, on a certain level innate in us to take good care of our nest, not the mm-hmm. the soil, the nest that we're in, the natural world that we're in. But it's just a shame that, as the signs that we often see, the protest signs, that there's too much profit over planet.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to talk to you about.
Yeah,
you know, not only are you up against climate deniers or people who don't want to get involved or don't want to admit that mm-hmm. this is happening. Mm-hmm. In almost everything, like I have a whole podcast about asking why. It's like, why this, why that?
Yeah.
and sometimes we have an answer, sometimes we don't. But mm-hmm. a lot of times mm-hmm. the answer is corporate greed.
Oh, yeah.
It's follow the money. Mm-hmm. And so America has to untether corporate greed from moral imperatives. And so mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was talking to someone the other day about... I was talking to them about plastic bags, and we could literally in the United States, we could have decomposable plastic, or we have everything we need. We have all the technology, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But well, why don't we have it? Why? Because plastic bags are made with petroleum. Mm-hmm, and what mm-hmm. is that? That's the oil industry. Mm-hmm, and the mm-hmm. oil industry funds political campaigns. Mm-hmm. And so literally almost everything we want, or things that are human decency, which I believe are human decency.
Yeah, yeah.
It's tied to big ag, big pharma, big oil. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question for you is, you or someone else who's not only fighting to get people to believe, but then also fighting a system that is calling itself representative democracy.
Yeah.
But it's not, because it's infiltrated with billionaire corporate CEOs. How do you still believe or have hope that there is change? And I know it's a big question.
Yeah, yeah. Hope comes through action. I mean, I love the David Orr quote that hope is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. And when I first got involved with Citizens Climate Lobby, what kind of hooked me in the group was I listened in on the phone call. They have a monthly meeting. It used to be that a speaker called up on the audio, and then since like the last 6 years now, it's been on 7 years, it's been on Zoom now. And the first call I listened to, the first thing they quoted Joan Baez that said, "Action is the antidote for despair." I mean, it's so, I'm at the point, Michael, where I can't read another article about how bad the climate crisis is. I just can't do it. I don't have the stomach for it. All I can do is just take action, is to go one day go to Salem, you know, to lobby elected officials there. Another day to go to a town hall, try to lobby elected officials. Go to different events locally here. Knock on doors for candidates. For me, I mean, I'm kind of like a shark in water. I think it's, what is it, sharks, if they're not swimming, they'll drown. What keeps me from drowning, you know, in despair is to just keep moving.
It also makes me think of a hummingbird looking for nectar.
Yeah, I mean, you have to...
It's like, get me the nectar. I need flowers with nectar.
Yes.
Okay, so what would progress or success look like to you, and what's bringing you hope that we'll potentially get there?
Yeah, yeah. Great question. Well, Al Gore lately has been talking a lot about, he's been talking about this for 20 years now. That
it's been a really inconvenient truth.
Oh, yes. Well, one of the things that Al Gore has been ringing the alarm bells up, he was doing this 20 years ago, is that in order to fix the climate crisis, we first have to fix the democracy crisis.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, we do.
Yeah. And so this is where I've been at since January 6th. I've been knocking on doors for candidates that'll be somewhat good on the environment.
You weren't at the Capitol doing the insurrection?
No, I was at home and I was just like, I was shaking. I mean, I was literally, I didn't know if I should cry or just, it felt like my stomach had been kicked in, because I love going to the U.S. Capitol. It's a sacred building
for
me.
Yeah, I love it as well.
If anybody ever has a chance to lobby at the U.S. Capitol, it's sacred to go there.
Yeah,
and meet with staff and members of Congress.
And what a beautiful thing that everyone from the country is together. They're supposed to be solving problems.
Yeah.
That's not always what happens, but there is some sort of beauty to that, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have reached the final segment.
Yeah.
And this is a fairly new segment. It's called Why Is It Like This? Mm-hmm. And so basically, it's one... you can name a person, a place, a thing, something that you think should be better by now. You can go off on a system, a product, a norm. Mm-hmm. So I'll go first.
Sure.
And then you can go. So I'm laughing because I don't know how this is going to come across, but mine today is guacamole being extra. One time for Halloween, I actually, my husband was... Winona Ryder's character from Stranger Things that year, and he would be like, well, is that you? And then I was a giant avocado, and I had a giant spoon with guac on it, and it said guac is extra, because that was scared to me when they hold up that guac. So mine is guac being extra. I get it, avocados are expensive, but if guac is literally part of the thing that you're buying. Mm-hmm. So if you're buying a California burrito, which has guac, that's the definition of a California burrito, you shouldn't be paying extra. But also, if someone's getting steak and bacon and cheese, they get all that. But I can't just have guac. Like, those things aren't expensive. So that's mine. Mine is that... Why is it like this? Why is guac extra?
Yes.
Why is it extra so much? So it's your turn. So what's something you think should be better?
Oh, well, you know what drives me nuts is whenever I'm at somewhere for breakfast, somebody always asks me, do you want coffee or tea? And it's like, I'm an orange juice person. I'm literally addicted to orange juice.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that there's something about that in the morning. It's like, and I know there's a number of orange juice drinkers or juice drinkers in the morning, but everyone assumes that we all drink coffee in the morning. And nothing against all the coffee drinkers.
Yeah, no,
out there.
Yeah, I get it.
But
so they don't say, like, do you want coffee, tea, or orange juice?
Yeah, it's just, do you want some coffee? And I never developed a taste for coffee.
Yeah,
I'm trying to keep on your level, Michael, because I was going to go the direction of, why aren't we all driving EVs? I was still going. I'm still in that climate mode.
No, that's great. And I'll let folks know. I drive an electric car, and not that it matters. And not that Brian and I are changing the world, but Brian took public transportation to get here and also likes to bike and is your, you in your everyday life, you do what you can or think about the things. I think that's something to remind folks of is we're not looking for perfection. We're looking for knowledge and growth and progress through action.
I like that, progress through action. Well said. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this podcast.
Oh, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and go get them. It's great seeing you out there in the community.
Oh, thank you. Great conversation, and hopefully we'll do lunch again soon. I enjoy our lunches that we do every few months.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, we've reached the end of this episode of All American Why. If you made it this far, congratulations. You're officially an excessive thinker, too. If something today made you laugh, cringe, or reconsider everything you thought you understood about this country, good. That's the point. Subscribe, rate, review, and share All American Why wherever you get your podcasts, including on YouTube. Or don't. It's still a free country for now. You can find me, Michael Jonas, on social media or at allamericanwhy.com, where we're building community for people who still give a damn. All American Why is filmed and recorded at X-Ray FM Studios in North Portland, Oregon. Original music by Renezra and Views. Audio editing by Kyle Gilmore of Residual Audio. Until next time, keep your curiosity loud, your optimism spiteful, and your democracy under constant surveillance. This is All American Why. Thank you for listening.
All American why? Ask yourself the American why.